Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Brendan Cooney, a writer and anthropologist, who explains why he believes Republican Party legislators have broken the law by supporting the illegal coup-installed government in Honduras. Neda Mishli and Maya Wind explain their decision to refuse Israeli military service and their call to Americans to stop supporting the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian West Bank through their tax dollars. And Martin Stoller, the attorney representing Elliot Madison, a man arrested for using Twitter to text message activists at the recent G20 protests in Pittsburgh. He explains what's at stake for civil liberties in the case. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While Barack Obama was delivering a strong message to Wall Street on the first anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, members of Congress were wheeling and dealing to protect the Wall Street profits made from complex derivatives. Derivatives are contracts that gamble on the future price of assets. Freshman Congressman Mike McMahon is pressing Barney Frank, the progressive chairman of the Financial Services Committee, on the need to protect the end users of derivatives. The end users are big corporations like IBM that use derivatives to hedge risks in currency markets, interest rates, and commodity prices. McMahon, an active member of the New Democrat coalition of self-proclaimed pro-growth Democrats, is working to weaken the new financial regulatory overhaul proposed by President Obama. According to Bloomberg Newswire, big Wall Street banks and brokerages like J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Credit Suisse Group are also lobbying the New Democrat coalition to protect the profit margin in derivatives transactions. In early October, Barney Frank released a draft of the financial reform bill that does not include any significant change in how standardized derivatives are traded so long as these trades are reported to federal regulators. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission and the Security Exchange Commission have criticized the Frank draft as being too weak because it excludes hedge funds and corporate end users from oversight. For a generation, San Francisco Chronicle Science reporter Sabin Russell covered the hotspots of global health and infectious disease, from the threats from bioterrorism to AIDS in Africa. As the swine flu epidemic, H1N1, was emerging in Mexico, Russell faced the corporate axe and he took a buyout, ending his long career with the Chronicle, even as he urged his paper to stay on top of the new flu epidemic. Dramatic cuts in mainstream newspapers have slashed science and health reporting. The Boston Globe, in the heart of the biotech corridor, last March eliminated its Monday science health sections and made severe cuts to its science desk. Other newspapers have shifted to softer stories on science, health, and fitness. Cable television has also cut back on science reporting in the drive to reduce costs. CNN has eliminated its entire science, space, and technology desk. Among those let go was Miles O'Brien, who covered the 2003 Columbia Space Shuttle disaster. Science reporters have been replaced by hundreds of science blogs on the Internet, but the quality of some blogs is a big question mark. The two science blogs which won the 2008 Weblog Awards were dedicated to militant atheism and the denial of global warming. These types of blogs don't appeal to a broad-based audience, nor do they provide perspective on new trends in science. The U.S. Department of Justice has stepped up its probe of anti-immigrant hate crimes in Suffolk County, New York, the eastern half of Long Island. The department's Civil Rights Division announced it is conducting an investigation of the Suffolk County Police Department to see if it has committed any systematic violations of constitutional protections. Pro-immigrant advocates assert the Suffolk police have engaged in racial profiling among Latino residents and failed to fully investigate hate crimes against Hispanics. According to Newsday, the complaint was filed after the November murder of Ecuadorian immigrant Marcelo Lucero. The victim was taunted and stabbed by seven local white youths, one of whom was eventually charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, Latinos in Suffolk County live in daily fear of violence and harassment. In addition, the county police have been accused of selective enforcement of traffic laws against Latino drivers. Foster Mayer, an attorney with Latino Justice, Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, sought the federal investigation, which should be completed in 18 months. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As the stalemate continues in the international effort to return the overthrown Honduran President Manuel Zelaya to power, a parade of Republican legislators have traveled from Washington to Honduras to support the coup government. 9 GOP members of the House and Senate, including Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina and Representative Ileana Ross-Lehtinen of Florida, have flown to the Honduran capital, Tegucigalpa, to support the de facto coup government's President Roberto Micheletti. The lawmakers stated they believe the coup that ousted Honduran President Zelaya was justified because of his stated intent to hold a non-binding referendum on changing the nation's constitution, which they argue could have removed presidential term limits, a fact disputed by many observers. Since the June 28th coup d'etat, the Honduran police and army have arrested more than 1,000 pro-Zelaya supporters, killed an estimated 14 civilians, and suspended civil liberties, shutting down opposition newspapers, radio, and television stations. The Republicans' embrace of the coup government in Honduras has staked out a position that justifies any action they see as working against the influence of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and his socialist agenda in Latin America. But with their actions, they are deliberately undermining the Obama administration's and universal international efforts to isolate the Micheletti regime and to push for a negotiated return of Zelaya to office before the scheduled November 29th Honduran presidential election. Meanwhile, President Zelaya, who covertly returned to Honduras on September 21st, has taken refuge in the Brazilian embassy, where he is awaiting negotiations that he hopes will restore him to power. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Brendan Cooney, a writer and anthropologist, who explains why he believes Republican Party legislators have broken the law by supporting the illegal coup-installed government in Honduras.
Well, there have been 9 congressional Republicans who have actually made trips down to Honduras and met with Roberto Micheletti, who is the de facto illegal leader in Honduras right now after the June 28th coup. There have been 3 different trips down there with these Republicans, a couple from the House and some from the Senate. And they've actually undercut President Obama's policy of not recognizing Micheletti by declaring Micheletti the president on their own. And now this is probably one of the clearest violations of the Logan Act in the United States history. It's the law that's been on the books since 1799, and there have been various accusations throughout our history, but this one seems to be one of the clearest violations.
Tell us what the Logan Act says and how it relates to what these Republicans have been up to in Honduras.
Sure. The Logan Act states that anyone who, without the authorization of the executive branch, of Obama in this case, quote, directly or indirectly commences or carries on any correspondence or intercourse with any foreign government or any officer thereof, with the intent to influence the conduct of that government, shall be fined or imprisoned not more than 3 years. So you can't undercut U.S. policy. It doesn't matter if you're a member of Congress. The president is the constitutional representative of the United States with regard to foreign nations, and that's been confirmed over and over again throughout our history.
Maybe give us some context here. How do we understand why Republicans have flocked to support a coup government, which has no basis of legitimacy, certainly in the way they sent Manuel Zelaya into exile in the dead of night in his pajamas, has nothing to do with the law of Honduras and everything to do with the military taking the law into its own hands and ejecting and exiling a democratically elected president? Why have the Republicans flocked to support such an illegitimate government?
Well, it just comes down to one thing. It's the fear of socialism. It's a throwback to the Cold War. And in these days, it's fear of Chavez, the president, democratically elected president of Venezuela. And Republicans are just scared that his influence is spreading throughout the hemisphere. Manuel Zelaya had recently become a friend of Chavez, and the right wing, both in the United States and in Honduras, the business community there, the right-wingers, didn't like that. And so that's why they got rid of him, and that's why Republicans are flocking down there to support the de facto head, Micheletti.
This issue of Republicans moving to support the coup government in Honduras, you know, is not widely covered here in the U.S. corporate press. But I wonder, how much pushback is there behind the scenes or maybe overtly from Congress and the White House in terms of the direct attempt to undermine the White House policy in isolating the Honduran regime?
Yeah, that's the curious thing here, is there doesn't seem to be any pushback at all. I haven't heard any complaints from Democrats, and certainly nothing from Obama. I know that Senator John Kerry tried to stop one of the delegations from going down there, the one by South Carolina, Senator Jim DeMint. But then DeMint just appealed, you know, to Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, and he wound up getting a Pentagon airplane to take him down there. Now, I haven't been able to get any answers from the Obama administration as to how that happened, but I'm completely stunned that nobody's looking into this.
What are the Republicans saying publicly when they arrive in the Honduran capital? Do they publicly support Micheletti? Are they saying there's a need for negotiation? Are they playing any constructive role here, or is it really taking on the sole function of undermining Obama's policy of isolating Micheletti and company?
Yeah, well, they say they're going down there on fact-finding missions. But then the language that they use once they get down there is quite shocking. Here's what Representative Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, who's the ranking Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said last week. She says, quote, "He is the president of Honduras." This is Micheletti, who's the illegal coup leader. She says, quote, "Some people tell me de facto government, but under the Constitution of the Republic, I am seated here with the president of this country, and it's a great honor." Now, that completely subverts the Obama administration's stated policy of not recognizing Micheletti, not talking with or meeting with Micheletti. So that is a flagrant violation of the Logan Act. By contrast, I should point out that others have been accused of breaking the Logan Act throughout history. McGovern, in 1975, was accused of violating the Logan Act by going to Cuba and meeting with Castro. And the State Department considered pressing charges against him, but they didn't because in his own report on the trip, he said, quote, "I made it clear I had no authority to negotiate on behalf of the United States, that I had come to listen and learn." And so there's a humility in McGovern's report about his trip. And if you compare that with the reports of these Republicans, it just completely flout Obama's stated policy. And to me, that's shocking. They say, well, we don't care what Obama says. This guy is the president of Honduras. That's stunning, and I think that should be looked into.
That was Brendan Cooney, a writer and anthropologist. Read his article, "Are Republicans Breaking U.S. Law in Honduras?" by visiting the online magazine counterpunch.org. For the past few years, about 200 graduating high school seniors, both male and female, have been refusing induction into the Israeli Defense Force because they object to Israel's occupation of the West Bank and its treatment of Palestinians both there and inside Israel. They make up just 1% of Israeli citizens who turn 18 each year. The other 99% follow the law and join the military. These refusers founded a group called in Hebrew Shemanitzim, meaning 12th graders in reference to the age when Israelis are drafted. Many of them have gone to jail multiple times. Two young women refuseniks just completed a month-long U.S. tour to talk about their experiences and to urge Americans to stop supporting the Israeli occupation through their tax dollars and through the purchase of goods made by Israel in the occupied West Bank. Netta Mishli and Maya Wind, both 19 years old, spoke about their decision to refuse Israeli military service at an October 6th public forum at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, during their U.S. tour. Netta got involved in youth organizing at age 15, and after turning 18, she refused to join the IDF, for which she served 20 days in jail. Maya refused induction in December 2008 and spent several weeks in jail and then 40 days in a military prison. Both women have since been declared exempt from military service, avoiding further imprisonment, but assigned to do alternative civilian service. Maya explains that 40% of Israeli young people don't serve in the military, but are granted exemptions based on being Orthodox Jews, mentally or physically unfit, or to women who are married. We first hear from Netta, who describes the consequences of her refusal of service.
When we came to the draft base on our draft day, saying that we're not joining the army, we were tried in an army court as soldiers. The way the army defines our crime is refusing an order, even though the order is to become a soldier from the beginning with. And the punishment for this kind of crime is between 7 and 35 days in military prison. When we finish to serve this time, we come back to the draft base. This is the order we get from jail. And meet an officer. In our case, it's the women's section officer. And she sits in front of us telling us, okay, you finish your time in the jail. Way to go. Now join the army. Of course, we are conscience objective. We would not join the army. And so lots of people need to go through this process over and over and over again, being jailed and released and jailed and released, some 6 times, 8 times, 2 times, depends individually. But the second you fill the conscience committee, the only way to get a release from the IDF is being unfit. Mentally unfit, physically unfit, generally unfit, it doesn't matter. This year we were all exempted from being mentally unfit. We're all crazy. But what's important is that the problem is always on the refusnik, always on the individual. There is nothing wrong with the system. And so if you find anything wrong with the system, you are apparently just not fit, unfit. But I want to tell you a little bit more about our group, because I think more than being a political power, which is a very small and minor political power inside Israel, we're also sort of a support group. Being a refusnik in Israel is a very isolated position. Although 40% of the people don't go to the army, there is a really small number of people who do it publicly. Generally, the national ethos, or the way that everyone feels, is that everyone go. It doesn't matter if it's not really the case, everyone go. So some of us, before they met the other members of the group or met the radical left in Israel, didn't know that there are more people who think like them. In our group, we go together to the draft base when someone is facing jail. We demonstrate to support him or her. We go outside of the prison wall, playing loud music or just chanting, screaming, so the person who's inside can hear that there is a group behind him or her supporting the ideas that this person is being jailed for. I know that as a refusnik, for me, it meant a lot that there is a group behind me, because I lost friends, because some of my family didn't really like the idea, and that was a really, this is one of the reasons I could refuse, because there were people who supported me. This is what my claim when I refused. I said, the occupation itself is an illegal order, and what the army is doing now is illegal by international law, and I refused to an illegal order. I went to jail.
Maya Wind explains the goal of the U.S. tour and feeling isolated as a consequence of refusing military service.
We're here touring because Americans, and actually most citizens of the world, are contributing to our occupation, and we're here to ask you to help us to end it. There are a lot of companies that profit from it, like I said, and their interests are keeping us there. And it would be wonderful if you as consumers would stop buying from these companies. And I know a lot of universities and colleges, for example, invest in Caterpillar, or a lot of other terrible companies, Motorola, a lot of other companies that are helping the occupation. And it would be wonderful if your schools would divest from them. Hampshire College is a great example of a university that divested from all the companies supporting the occupation. It would be great if colleges throughout the United States could do that. And certainly as personal consumers, if you're interested in helping us create justice in Israel-Palestine, this is one way to go about it.
One audience member asked Maya what jail was like.
It's not Guantanamo, and I assure you that Palestinian prisons in Israel, totally different story. Palestinian prisons in Israel do have very serious conditions, and a lot of them are very abused physically, emotionally. For us, it was just verbal abuse. People often ask me, what was jail like? And I have to tell you, jail was not the hardest part for me at all. What was hard is social rejection. What was hard is that I've lost my place in mainstream Israeli society, and I don't think I'll ever get it back. That's what hurts me. Not prison, not detention, not the jobs I can't get. For me, what hurts is that every time I have to go somewhere, I have to justify myself and I have to reclaim my position as an Israeli because people doubt it and people see me as a traitor or people hate me and curse at me. That's what hurts and that was hard for me. So for me, jail was really not the worst of it.
That was Maya Wind and Netta Mishley, two members of Sheminitzim, who were on a month-long U.S. tour sponsored by Code Pink. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on companies that invest inside the Israeli-occupied West Bank, visit the website of the Coalition of Women for Peace at whoprofits.org. Elliot Madison, a 41-year-old social worker and self-described anarchist from Queens, New York, traveled to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in late September, where he set up a communications network for activists during protests held at the Group of 20 or G20 summit meeting. The protesters, representing a diversity of causes, demanded that wealthy nations more aggressively address the world's economic and environmental crises, an end to U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and advocated for African debt relief. While the protests were mostly peaceful, there were running confrontations between the so-called militant Black Bloc contingent who were accused of defying police and smashing windows. Madison was arrested by Pennsylvania State Police on September 24th at his Pittsburgh hotel room and charged with hindering apprehension or prosecution, criminal use of a communications facility, and possession of instruments of crime. Madison was accused of using police scanners to disseminate information about law enforcement movements to demonstrators through the social networking site Twitter. After Madison was released on bail, the FBI conducted a 16-hour search of his house in New York City on October 5th, where they seized computers, black masks, financial records, books, and posters. The search warrant stated agents were looking for evidence of violations of federal rioting laws. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Martin Stoller, an attorney representing Elliot Madison, who explains what's at stake for civil liberties in this case.
The search warrant that was executed at Mr. Madison's residence in Queens, New York, called for the seizure of various items which are evidence of violations of federal anti-rioting laws. Now, the federal anti-rioting laws that are talked about are rarely used, and in fact, the most recent example that I can think of is the use, following the Democratic National Convention in Chicago of 1968, against a group who became known as the Chicago Eight. It's a statute that's rarely used and has all sorts of First Amendment implications. But if that is indeed what the government is investigating, let them go ahead and investigate it. We are bordering on some very serious deprivations of civil liberties if the Obama administration and the Obama Justice Department want to prosecute such things. But that's what the warrant said to seize. Now, the next question becomes, what exactly is evidence of violations of federal anti-rioting laws that the agents were directed to seize? I can't conceive of what an agent would go looking for to find evidence of the violation of anti-rioting laws. In fact, what they wound up seizing were publications, magazines, books, posters, backpacks that contained emergency response equipment, which include respirators, which are used by Mr. Madison and some of his associates as part of a community emergency response team. So it's hard for me to conceive of how the officers who are executing this warrant that says search for evidence of violations of federal anti-rioting laws, what are they directed to search for? It's the strongest violation of the Fourth Amendment that I can think of because the officers are given totally unfettered discretion to decide on their own what it is that might be evidence of violations of federal anti-rioting laws. There's no direction given to them as to what such evidence might be, much like you would get in a search warrant dealing with a drug case. We are completely in never-never land here for the officers to try to figure out what it is might be evidence of that. How about the political posters that were on the wall? Are those evidence of violations of federal anti-rioting laws? Apparently, the officers thought so because they seized a whole bunch of posters, things that are national and international concern to people who have a political consciousness about things that have taken place around the world. Posters are not evidence. Books are not evidence. So it's kind of a very strange search, and it took them 16 hours going through the entire residence plus the greenhouse and the garage to come up with a whole series of things which, from my point of view, do not respond to the warrant.
As you look at this case, what are the broader implications here and what's at stake for civil liberties? And I'm thinking about in terms of what's in the mind of our listeners if they go to an occasional protest. Really, how could this negatively affect people's rights to express opposition or support for government action in this country in the future?
Well, this kind of conduct and going after people who are demonstrating and people who support those who are demonstrating would definitely have a chilling effect on people's exercise of their First Amendment right to protest, to demonstrate, to petition their government for redress of grievances. All conduct which is protected in this country by the First Amendment. Any aspect of government interference with that right would have a chilling effect. And the idea, unfortunately, on the government's part is to send a message out to people who want to engage in protest, who want to say that certain government or social policies are incorrect or should be changed, are in jeopardy for doing so. That's completely antithetical to our constitutional bases and to the very fabric of American society.
Martin Stoller, it's ironic that U.S. officials have supported very strongly the use of social networking tools like Twitter for protesters opposing the Iranian government and other nations that the United States classifies as enemies. How is it that we can endorse, the government of the United States, endorse protesters using Twitter and other tools like this abroad, but we arrest people here at home?
Well, it would seem to be a contradiction, wouldn't it? It's the type of contradiction that I hope will lead to the dismissal of the case against Mr. Madison.
That was Martin Stoller, an attorney representing Elliot Madison. Read more about allegations of police misconduct at the G20 protests on the website of the Pennsylvania chapter of the ACLU at aclupa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.